And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
They call it buzz in the news industry when something captivates us and captures our attention. Earlier this year, there was a terrific amount of buzz about the bees and the lack of buzz in the bees. And we all expected that somehow this buzz would continue so that we could get to the bottom of what in the world was happening to cause the extraordinary disappearance of some of the most important little creatures on this planet, the honeybees that pollinate our fruit and our flowers, our vegetables, and crops of all kind. Today, we go in depth as we find out why the buzz on the bees has been so silent. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As I was getting ready to do today's show, which actually was on Wednesday, decided to take a little break about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Got my bird, put her on my knee, and we grabbed a little ice cream and sat down in front of the television and turned on CNN, and I saw this horrific picture of this bridge that was falling all over the place. And of course, when you come into something like that, you don't really know quite where it is or why it is. And it was, it kind of panned back and the image of the disaster became ever more apparent. And they were talking about the fact that this, then you kind of wonder, is this actually happening now or is this some sort of historic memory, you know, that we're watching here? But it was apparent that it was actually happening. And so I was curious, and I listened, and then they mentioned that this was in Minneapolis, and all of a sudden, everything changed, because I knew exactly where that bridge was, the 35W bridge in Minneapolis, crossing the Mississippi River, right over by the university. I went to the University of Minnesota. As a matter of fact, I started there about the year that the bridge was completed, the 35W bridge. And I live just a few blocks away from where this happened. What can one say except that it was and is a most horrific tragedy? So it kind of slowed things down for me for quite a bit because I couldn't pull away from the television. It was very personal in many respects, brought back a lot of memories. I know the people that are in Minnesota. I know how they'll respond to this. They're brave, they're strong, and they're also very passionate people. And tragedies like this are felt very, very deeply, as it is with any people. But I'm a Minnesotan, so it has a particular significance to me. So I wish to extend my sympathies to all of my friends in Minnesota who are going through this right now. There's really not much that can be said that's good about it, and time will pass, and so too the pain. I'm so sorry to see this. So we have to get on with things, and so too today. We carry on with the Wild Side News, and in just a moment we're going to start the show with a Weekly Earth Summit. We have some great commentary on this week's Weekly Earth Summit. Then in segment two, we're going to go in depth to relook at what has happened to the story about the disappearing honeybees. It's an amazing story, one that was really quite shocking, that the honeybees, so responsible for pollinating our food crops and keeping us all in fresh vegetables and fruits and grains and many other things, actually keeping our entire system alive here, because every plant needs to be pollinated, and it's the majority, the bulk, the hard work is done by the bees, but they were disappearing in great, great numbers. So I thought perhaps we'd start hearing more about that, and I certainly was curious as a, particularly because I'm a scientist, I'm going like, what in the world happened? Well, in segment two, we're going to go in depth with someone who's been involved in the bee industry for 40 years to bring you up to date, and I think you're going to find it interesting. Whereas in the media, I just really haven't heard much at all about this story. There is a story, and you're going to hear that in segment two. It's one that we all need to be truly aware of because it's in our society. The problem is perhaps very definable. We need more science. We need more funding. We need more honesty to get to the bottom of this situation with the honeybees. But first, the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sidney Wildsmith. We bring you the thoughts of some of the world's leading experts in the fields of animal behavior, sustainability, activism. I'd like to start out this Weekly Earth Summit with a commentary by the legendary Dave Foreman, who brings us up to date on a controversy that's swirling around in the desert Southwest with a wonderful twist. Dave?
Down here in New Mexico and Arizona, we're having a full-on mass hysteria event in rural areas of southwestern New Mexico, southeastern Arizona, where the Mexican wolf was reintroduced in the Gila Wilderness area and Gila National Forest and Apache National Forest around it. There's been quite a bit lately about people claiming their children are suffering from post-traumatic syndrome and other things because of fear of wolves. Well, of course, the fear of wolves has been whipped up by their parents down there. A number of ranching mothers have been quoted in the paper about this terror. And so, interestingly, some other Gila mothers decided to comment on this. And what I have is a little statement from 11 women who are mothers who live in rural areas around the Gila National Forest and the Mexican Wolf Reintroduction Area. And I will quote from them. Michael White of the Farm Bureau purports to stand up for local residents whose so-called solid opposition to Mexican gray wolf reintroduction in the, quote, cities, towns, and rural areas, end quote, of the Gila has been ignored by the government. He claims that, quote, the day will come when a child or another person is maimed or killed by government-sponsored wolves, end quote. Our diminutive Mexican wolves may be scary from Mr. White's perch in Las Cruces, but here on the ground things look differently. We are mothers living in rural areas of southwestern New Mexico, away from town limits, at the edge of the Gila National Forest. We hike, sometimes alone with our kids. We already watch out for our children in the face of mountain lions, black bears, javelinas, and rattlesnakes, not to mention more prosaic dangers. We live in the Gila because we cherish its wildness, including glimpses of wild animals. Mr. White's scare tactics are not new claims for the Farm Bureau, an insurance company owning behemoth that decades ago strongly supported the original extermination of wolves from the western United States. Back on May 16, 2000, the Farm Bureau put out a press release claiming that rural resident Rene Dupree, quote, was attacked by Mexican gray wolves, end quote, and was, quote, rescued by two local U.S. Forest Service employees in the face of this life-threatening attack, end quote, adding, quote, no human is a match for a starving pack of wolves in a feeding frenzy, end quote. But Ms. Dupree was quoted in the May 17, 2000 Silver City Sun News saying, quote, my dog saw the wolves and one of them ran after them. The wolves saw the dog coming and one of them came toward me, apparently because he was curious about the other dog I was holding. I really didn't feel threatened myself, but I was a little concerned about the dogs, end quote. The Farm Bureau's wolf attack was fiction, And now the organization is ringing the same bell again, hoping to gin up more fear. Mexican wolves deserve to live in the Gila, their only home. This is also our home and serves as a vital part of the classroom that our children learn in. We strive to foster respect and care for all life. We deeply appreciate the gift of wildness we share with our families. Yes, there are inevitable inconveniences of living near wild animals, and no wildlife should be taken for granted or assumed to be predictable and safe. But the real dangers to children lie elsewhere. In recent months, a child in southwestern New Mexico died due to an unsecured handgun. A teenager on a ranch suffered a grievous eye injury from a kick by her horse. Earlier this week, a 12-year-old boy died in a stock tank. Why does the Farm Bureau scapegoat wolves in the face of real dangers? This is Dave Foreman. I think that's a very good question to ask. I want to thank these brave mothers for standing up and talking a little sense in this crazy world down there.
Thanks, Dave, and your friends down there in southwestern New Mexico, for your thoughts about wolves in America. It makes me remember of a time when I was in Yellowstone National Park as the artist in residence, and I had people creating art of all forms, including their comments and writing and poetry and other things. And there was a short piece that appeared on the wall, as I had everybody put their pieces on the wall, which feels so appropriate to follow what Dave Foreman just had to say. This was the second year in which wolves had been reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park, which had been a very controversial issue for people surrounding the parks. There were all sorts of fears, just like Dave brought forward in his commentary today. This was written by, she signed it, an enlightened adult from Idaho Falls, Idaho. I heard a wolf. I had mixed emotions. My father is a rancher. My name is on petitions to keep the wolves in Canada. But I heard a cry in the calm evening dusk. Tears came to my eyes and a chill up my spine. I felt fear. I felt joy. This is right. This is a good thing. The wolves are home. Hopefully that'll make its way back to New Mexico. Dr. Mark Beckhoff continues discussing some of the things that he learned during his trip to Tasmania to visit with other animal behaviorists. He shares his perspective on some changing views of animals through time as expressed by the members of his scientific community. Dr. Beckhoff?
Just looking at animals in history, how animals have been viewed and used, Neat talked about how animals were once held accountable for their acts. So, you know, there was a famous trial of a pig in France who had apparently killed a young boy. Animals in literature, the way that they're represented, and the changes over time from seeing animals represented as kind of automatons, you know, these Cartesian robots with no feelings, to being viewed as sentient beings. Metaphors using animals, animals, there was a phenomenal paper at this meeting in Tasmania that looked at how dogs were viewed in Japan during World War II and how they were symbols of compassion, attachment, hope, and things like that. You know, so it was just sort of seeing how the Japanese looked at dogs as a function of what was happening, you know, in their country. You know, gender issues, some talks on speciesism and feminism, and speciesism, you know, being the view that all and only members of a certain species, say, are emotional or, are smart or can do certain tasks. And then looking at how using speciesism is sort of parallel to feminism and the marginalization, if you will, of animals and women, stuff like that. So just phenomenally broad, broad topics. Oh, and wonderful stuff on looking at, New Zealand and Australia and especially Tasmania. They're faced with an invasion of non-native species and how you resolve balancing the interests and the rights of non-natives versus natives and trying to be compassionate, which, of course, is about the tallest order you can ever have.
Thank you, Dr. Beckhoff. We'll be hearing a lot more from Mark in the months ahead. And finally, Dr. Charles Kennel always has an amazing perspective on the future of this planet, and he is a man who is making things happen. He's a decision maker. He's a change agent. And he's involved in setting up a global sustainability network to monitor many of the dynamics on this planet. So when he talks not about things that may be, but things that are to be. Dr. Kennel.
I think at the research level, for us in the universities and those of us who do environmental and sustainability initiatives, is my new responsibility. I think the frontier is to get the scientists and the engineers working directly with the economists side by side on the same project. It's not just that the economists can take the results of the science after it's done and then estimate the cost and so forth. As you're beginning to develop new technologies for understanding the environment and then making altering the way we deal with it, at every step of the way now, you need to understand the economic impacts. You can't, in a system in which human beings are interacting with nature to give us the situation we have, you absolutely cannot. The economic dimension is essential in determining whether determining what we do as a society in many ways. You know, a new technology may be absolutely enchanting, very exciting, scientifically challenging, but if you can't make the business case or if you can't see where, can't make a convincing statement of need for this technology, it won't get built and we'll waste our time. And we scientists will waste our time chasing the wrong objective. And so we really do need the economists tightly on board as we make climate predictions, for example. The economists are going to say things like, well, okay, so there's going to be a shortage of rainfall. All right, well, tell me where. And so the climate scientists will say, well, tell me where you need it. And the economist is going to say where the most critically dependent, water-dependent activities are. And so the climate scientist says, well, okay, where's that? And they have to go back and forth and specialize their prediction down to the things, down so that the scientists predicting climate change can actually predict it in a way that's meaningful to the people who are affected. And you can estimate the economic impact, where the water shortage will be in your neighborhood, what the options are for storing water, transporting it from elsewhere. If you get your water from some other state, what is climate change going to do to the sources of water outside of California? And you need to know all of those things. You need the economists to help you estimate the economic impacts of large-scale changes so that the financial community will be more aware in the way it invests. So for a whole variety of reasons, the frontier, I think, of research right now is climate-aware economic forecasts and economic-aware climate forecasts. And then finally, just completely integrated. So it'll be one thing.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. I like to think of this as the frontiers of sustainability. Sustainability is absolutely critical for our future. We all know that. Thanks to the work of so many people, like all of my listeners and so many of their friends and allies, we have to keep up our work to unite our efforts. One of the issues that's challenging our capacity to be truly sustainable is the issue of the honeybees, which this last spring made it to the front pages because they were suddenly disappearing. Since then, we haven't heard much about the honeybees, and so in just a moment, we're going to bring you the information you need to know to find out what's happening to the honeybees in America. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a lot on planet Earth that we take for granted. So often it's the little things that we just don't think about that in reality play such a role maintaining our health and our well-being. This spring, we heard that the honeybees were disappearing, just plain gone from sight. What happened? We're finding out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Earlier this year, America was hit with a story that was very personal to a lot of people. The honeybees were suddenly disappearing. It was discovered that honeybees were just disappearing en masse in thousands and thousands of hives across America. Today we're going in depth in our second segment to find out what's happened, what have we learned about the disappearance of the honeybees. This is an important story, and I encourage you all, take the time to listen, because this is a story that we're not hearing much about. And there's a reason for that, as you'll find out as we go in depth with what has happened to America's honeybees. This last spring, there was this huge story that suddenly kind of shocked the nation that said that the honeybees in America, we're disappearing in great numbers. And what that means is that the hives that contain thousands and thousands of bees, in the spring, suddenly they were gone. And that's a mystery. And it was really very extensive. It spread throughout much of the United States. And it affected a large number of hives and beekeepers. And since that time, people have been going, what in the world is going on? It seemed as if this was kind of a new thing. Well, here we are down the road a bit, and I certainly am curious to find out what's happened to that story. And in the process of beginning to look into things, as so often happens, the story gets just a little bit strange. Well, someone who's been involved with beekeeping for a very long time is Dave Hackenberg of the Hackenberg Apiaries. Dave, I want to welcome you to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, talk about your life. You have quite an operation there.
Well, I've been running bees for 44, 45 years. Started keeping bees in 1962 with the Voag Project in high school, and now it's my son and myself and several employees, and we run several thousand hives of bees in four or five states, and basically pollinating crops and producing some honey.
It's quite a life. It's not just a matter of making bees. You have to work pretty hard to get those bees where they need to be used, don't you?
That's correct. I mean, it's our business is providing bees for growers to pollinate crops to provide food, you know, to put on America's dinner table.
Right. Without the bees, we don't eat.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about let's take a look at one of your years. Where do you have to go throughout a year to conduct your business?
Well, right now, our bees are either in New York producing honey or here in Pennsylvania pollinating pumpkins. These pumpkins are not for eating. These pumpkins are the ones that people buy for ornaments and so on and so forth, gourds. About 1,000 acres of pumpkins we're pollinating right now. Fall rolls around September and October. These bees all go back on the tractor trailers and get shipped back to Florida for the fall and winter. And there they'll go on to into locations where we basically maintain them and try to get them some food And if we can't get them natural food, we feed them sugar syrup and also feed them pollen patties and to help supplement the feed they're getting. And they'll be in these holding yards until winter locations until some of them in January will probably make a trip to California to pollinate almonds, the end of January, 1st of February to pollinate almonds. And the rest of them that's left behind, they will be there to go on to citrus crop, oranges and grapefruits and so on in late February or early March. And at the same time, we'll take the bees that we have left. We always have our winter losses but the ones that are left, we start making up our splits and making up new hives to start the new year and start back up the East Coast. And the first thing coming north will be pollinating apples. We normally move everything back out of Florida about the 15th of April and come into Pennsylvania, pollinate apples the end of April and early part of May, and then move on into Maine to pollinate blueberries in May and early June. And then we're back here where we are now again with a bunch of bees in upstate New York producing honey and also bees on back on pumpkins.
Tell us about this spring for you. Were you impacted?
Well, actually, this whole thing actually started last November. I mean, we didn't really hit the news and get out in the news until probably into early February. But actually, I'm the guy that's accused of being the guy to find this problem. And my last semi-load of bees left Pennsylvania on October the 11th. And I actually drove them to South myself and put them out in some good pepper locations. This Brazilian pepper, it's a wild plant that grows in Florida, and put these bees on these wild pepper locations to get some fall feed onto them. We came back, my son and I and a herd man came back on November the 12th into this one particular location that had 400 hives of bees in it, 100 pallets, 400 hives of bees. Pulled in there late in the afternoon, was going to move them because the landowner there, we have an agreement with him, we have him out of there by early November because he uses that land for some other purposes. And we pulled in there and started normally, jumped out of the truck. One of us got on a forklift. My son got on the forklift. I lit a smoker and started smoking bees. And after smoking about four or five pallets, I realized that I don't think there's anybody home here. And we started jerking covers up and started looking. And then it got pretty frantic-y and turned out there was less than 40 hives of bees alive out of those 400. And this all happened within a month. Those were exceptionally good looking hives of bees when they hit the ground in Florida on October 11th, and by November 12th, they had just flat disappeared. And the mysterious thing, and the thing that really, really made me start to wonder what was going on, was the fact that inside these hives, there was still honey. There was brood left behind, and bees don't go off and leave their brood. I mean, it's like people going off and leaving their kids. And there was honey left behind, and that's not doesn't happen because there's so many bees in that particular area that, in fact, probably 100 to 120 yards away from where my bees were sitting, set another 100 hives of bees, and them bees did not even come and rob the honey out of the boxes, which is normally what happens to dead outs. The other bees come in and clean out the honey. The other thing I noticed was the fact that there was no wax moth and no small hive beetles there. They're usually moving into hives and starting their predators, and they start to take over long before the hive is even completely dead. And they weren't there, which was really, really kind of amazing. And so after a couple more days of looking around and finding some more bees that looked like they were collapsing and some that had already disappeared, I basically loaded up a lot of this dead stuff and some of the stuff that was still alive and brought it back to Penn State and the USDA and basically Penn State, and of course the USDA got involved, but so that was the beginning of it in November and through December, and of course along about sometime in early February the news media got wind of what was going on, and by that time we were starting to see bees die. I mean, there was other people within the next couple weeks after we found this, there was bees in Georgia and on the East Coast, and at first they thought it was something wrong that was going on the East Coast, but by mid-December, late December, and then into January, it was in Texas and California, and the number of states started out at a half a dozen, and then it was 15 or 16, and then it was 20 and 22, and now I guess 36 or more states have been affected. And by the time the dust all settled this spring or sometime the numbers that the apiary inspectors of America are throwing around are somewhere, probably about a third of the bees that was in the United States vanished last year in this collapse, or whatever you want to call it, or disappearance, and which probably totals to somewhere between 600,000 and 800,000 hives.
After 40 years of working in the industry, this had never happened to you before to this extent.
No, not to this extent. I mean, we've gone through a lot of things. You know, reporters talk about, and some people talk about the disappearances we've had in the past. And I mean, somebody just wrote an article the other day that said it was 14 disappearances in the 1900s and in of bees. But normally, disappearance is all related to a small, just a small area where, it was something that was could have been weather related, or a couple of things. I mean, there was, some of them have never been determined, and some of them have. But the thing is that it's never been this widespread.
Mm-hmm.
We lost bees to the mites back in the 80s when the varroa mites came, but that was pretty much, if you didn't take care of the mites, they took care of you.
Yeah.
And if you were on top of the mites, well, you managed the bees. There's a lot of things. One of the things that's also happened here over the last number of years is the fact that we've lost a lot of beekeepers, and we lost a lot of numbers of bees because of mites and economics and the price of honey. It's not anywhere where you can make a living producing honey anymore because of the imports. And so it's basically, if you're not a pollinator and into pollination on a big way, you just can't depend on a honey crop to basically pay your bills. This disappearance last year, what we've seen, we know that a couple years last year, I mean, the year previous and also the year previous to that, some of us had some losses that we couldn't really put our finger on, and we now think that they were probably similar, if not the same situation. Only thing not near the magnitude that we're talking about. I mean, we were talking, hundreds of hives of bees, per beekeeper. Now we're talking thousands and thousands of bees.
So it was kind of a crescendoing over the last 2 to 3 years.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm a biologist, so I look at this and I say, wow, something happened over a vast area of the United States that affected populations of bees almost everywhere. And then there's only so many possibilities, and I'm sure amongst the beekeepers themselves, there was a lot of discussion about what it might be. Talk a little bit about what some of the early information that came out of the gate within your community.
Well, on March the 14th, I wrote a letter to my growers, and that letter became kind of famous. It's been around the world, and I didn't send it there. It's in the halls of Congress, and I didn't send it there either. But basically, what I said to my growers was the fact that something, just what you got done saying, something out here has changed. I mean, something. And I've grown up in agriculture. I was born and raised in the dairy business, and I've been around farming all my life. I own a small farm, two small farms, and I don't farm, but I have a friend of mine that farms for me, and so I'm pretty close to what's going on in agriculture. And, of course, the only thing that I know of that has changed in the last 3 years, or dramatically in the last 3 years, is the fact that we have switched insecticides. We've gone from hard insecticides, organic phosphates, and those kind of insecticides, to switched over to neonicotinoids, imidacorprates, and because manufacturers of these products say they're a lot safer to man and to mammals, and they only affect the insects. They also state that these are friendly to adult pollinators. In their literature and their advertising and their labeling, and these products are systemic. They are made with a nicotine base. They're called just like the name says, neonicotinoid. And if it's seed treatment, coating of a seed, or it's sprayed on as a foliar spray, it basically is absorbed into the plant and into the tissues. And this is how it works against the insects. The target is insects.
And it's been very effective in terms of eliminating insect pests from a whole series of crops. It certainly does its job fairly well, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, talking to farmers, I've talked to a lot of farmers in the last 6 months, they're impressed with the stuff because, they've been able to take their put their sprayers away for the most part, and they've been able to take their insecticide boxes off their corn planters and their seed, their row crop or seed planters or soybean drills and so on and so forth. And you put the insecticide on the seed, it grows up through the plant, and it takes care of the bugs. The manufacturers of this product says it does 3-4 things. It basically wipes out the immune system of the targeted insect, causes a memory loss, causes them their nervous systems to become disorders in their nervous system, and causes the insects to quit feeding. Well, that's exactly what we have seen happen in the honeybee colonies. Backing up into October, September, and October, besides running bees, I deal in bee supplies and bee feed to other beekeepers. Started selling sugar. We sell sugar syrup to beekeepers. I had a beekeeper here locally bought sugar syrup in September and called me 2 weeks later and said the bees won't eat this stuff. And I said, well, that's funny because I got guys buying this stuff and I've got the same tank and have no problem whatsoever. The gentleman actually had it checked out to make sure it was okay. And, I didn't know that at the time, but found it out later and found out that there was nothing wrong with the sugar syrup. But his bees wouldn't take it down. That fellow was running 1,200 hives of bees, and by the time spring rolled around, he had 200, probably 80 left out of 1,200, but they just quit eating and would not eat. We've seen the same thing happen, actually, 2 years ago, in some bees that had went through pumpkins and some other things. But one of the problems in this bee business is the fact that we have lived with mite since the mid-80s, and new viruses carried by the mites. And we have pretty much come to the mindset that every time something happens, that you blame it on the mites and you blame it on the viruses, something you can't see. And 2 years ago, when we had lost probably 400 hives of bees to probably the same situation, they wouldn't take feed, and they dwindled down to nothing in a matter of a month, we basically figured that we had picked up a new virus from the mites and just wrote it off.
That's kind of the catch-all. It's probably a virus or some sort of fungus.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the other things that I forgot to mention earlier about another symptom of this whole thing is, and normal beekeeping practices forever and ever was we took our dead-out beehives, the ones that died from queenlessness or natural causes or whatever, and we stacked these beehives over on good hives, and they raise brood. The queen will move up into that brood box that had died and put brood in there, and eventually we'll set them off and put a new queen in them.
Mm-hmm.
When we take these hives that have died or have disappeared from this colony collapse disorder and put them on good beehives, within a month, you wipe out the good beehive.
Wow.
And that's what we've seen happen 2 years ago. We again did some of that this year and real quick figured out that something else is wrong here. There's something in these hives that is basically, that's why nothing is coming in and robbing the honey, and nothing is coming in. The moth and the beetles aren't taking over.
Well, one of the aspects about this whole story that also was such an enigma, and that's the fact that let's say there was a population that became ill, you typically find sort of a dispersal of dead bodies, decreasing as the farther you got away from the hive. But in this particular case, there's just no evidence that you can't find the bees.
It's like somebody took a sweeper and swept them clean. There's nothing there. There's no dead bees in front of the hives. There's no dead bees in the hives. I've never, in my 40-some years of keeping bees, yes, like you said earlier, if we got mites, there's dead bees out, and you got, a carpet of dead bees. If you got insecticide poisoning normal insecticide poisoning, the old hard chemicals that we've used, farmers use
right.
in agriculture and, everybody else used for years. When you got hit with insecticides, you knew you got hit because the bees were dead right there. You didn't have to look twice, and you didn't have far to go look. Now, it's months later after you come in contact with these things that you start to realize that something is going wrong.
Well, that's been part of the interesting story, and that's it. It's as if the bees just sort of wandered off and either couldn't figure out how to get back or something like that. Why don't you talk about some of your observations and analysis of what you think is happening to them? Why aren't they coming back? What's happening to them?
What what I really, you know, I think, and you know, I'm just a beekeeper, but that just for 40-some years, but what I really think's happening, you know, some of the scientists that are working on this tend to agree, is the fact that, and the manufacturers say this is not, this will not hurt, harm adult beneficials, and, you know, it won't kill them. That's right. But basically what's happened is they're collecting pollen from these plants and carrying it back to the hive, storing it there, and using it at a later date when the pollen, the natural pollen coming in from outside gets short, they start using this pollen to raise their young. And in this particular case in Florida where, you know, what happened to us, we had a cold front come through right after those bees hit the ground. On a cold front in Florida means it went from 80 and 90 degrees down to daytime temperatures in the low 70s, and the nights dropped down 20 degrees cooler than it was. But what happens is plants quit yielding nectar and quit producing pollen. So the bees are already raising brood, so they got to continue to raise that brood because the larva and pupa are there and they have to feed them. So they pull the brood, they pull the pollen out that they've stored a month or two before. And if this pollen is contaminated with these nicotinoids, then basically what's happening is we're feeding that chemical at low dosages, not at anything really that high, but at sublethal dosages. It's not killing them, but it's affecting their systems. And one of the things it seems to be affecting is their memory. And of course, one of the things we see in these hives, when we start looking at hives that aren't already totally gone by the time we get there, is the fact that you'll have a good beehive and all of a sudden you have a beehive that's got 8 frames of brood and it's don't got enough bees in there to take care of the brood. And the bees that take care of the brood are the young bees. And so that what's happening is they're starting to disappear. And when they start to go off and fly, you know, they start to disappear. Well, then what happens is you got your number, your population starts dwindling down, and so some of the young bees that are taking care of the brood, they go out and start gathering food because now we don't have enough field bees out there because something's happening and they're disappearing, and eventually the whole thing just keeps coming back and you got around, keeps going round and round, and next thing you know there's no bees left in the hive and all you got is brood. And a lot of times you'll find a queen and a handful of bees, and that's it, and the brood, and, you know, what happened, you know. Some of the scientists said that in California last year, in January and February, they literally seen beehives disappear, what they thought were good beehives, going through operations, looking for symptoms of this situation. They seen beehives literally disappeared in 4 days.
Part of the difficulty here is the fact that the manufacturers of nicotinoids, I guess is the proper way to say it. Is that correct?
Neonicotinoids, yes.
Yeah, neonicotinoids. Made the claim that it would definitely affect insects, but it wouldn't affect the pollinators, which unfortunately are insects, that somehow they were not affected by this, which just from the surface doesn't make much sense, you know.
While we're on that subject, one of their other on their literature for apples and oranges and other fruits, too, particularly, is they have a product called a sale, and Provado and some other ones, but they all got great names. But anyhow, it says, this product is safe for use during bloom, in big letter, in bold letters or in bright letters or whatever, depends on which label you're looking at. But then in parentheses, or if it has behind it, not when bees are present. Well, if you're pollinating apples or apples are in bloom, there's always bees present. If there's oranges blooming, you always got bees present. Some of the scientists have gone to EPA and said this is false advertisement. They just kind of shrug their shoulders and say, well, you know, that's the farmer's responsibility. He needs to be able to read a label.
Well, you know, the research on neonicotinoids actually goes back quite a few years. France, for example, a number of years back, came to the conclusion that it was the neonicotinoids that was affecting their honeybee crops years ago. And so France, for example, banned to a large degree the use of those chemicals. But here we are in the United States, and for some reason that information doesn't seem to be available. And then I doing some research, I came across something that says that it was research actually provided by the EPA. This is from the EPA fact sheet. And it says in honey, I'll just read this, okay, because I think this is really, really significant. Talking about the neonicotinoids, it says, in honeybees, the effects of the toxic chronic exposure may include lethal and or sublethal effects in the larva and reproductive effects in the queen. Documented sublethal effects, in other words, if it doesn't kill them, then it may have these effects. Documented sublethal effects of neonicotinoids include physiological effects that impact enzyme activity, leading to, are you ready for this, impairment of olfactory memory, which I guess means that, what does olfactory memory, tell me from a beekeeper's perspective.
That means their memory got lost and they didn't come home.
Yeah, right. And as well, behavioral effects are reported on motor activity that impact, okay, navigation, orientation, and feeding behavior. And additional research has found that imidacloprid, impairs, here we go, the memory and brain metabolism of bees, particularly the area of the brain that is used for making new memories. Well, isn't that what you were just saying was happening?
That's correct.
So how do we take this EPA information and balance that up against what the manufacturers are saying?
Well, public doesn't understand about EPA is the fact that several years ago they have basically, they've left the chemical companies kind of run wild in the fact that they basically now self-certify themselves. They basically self-certify their products. And so if the chemical company says, yeah, it's okay, well, that's fine and dandy, but then if something goes wrong, and in this case, an insider inside EPA told me back in February that we've seen a lot of red flags in this stuff, but, you know, somebody higher up gave the order to put it out there, and if something goes wrong, we'll fix it later. The problem is that once it's time to fix it, it's not the responsibility of the chemical company to prove there's a problem. It's the responsibility of the public, or in this case, the beekeeping industry, or whoever, to prove to, you know, EPA and whoever, if there's a problem.
You have to go to court to prove this.
That's right.
And I don't know how big and massive the beekeeping industry is.
Well, unfortunately, there's about 1,300 commercial beekeepers left in the United States. And my theory on that, there isn't enough of us left to win an election of a mayoratorial race in some little town anymore.
Well, and unfortunately, for example, Monsanto is one of the manufacturers, the main manufacturer, of some of the neonicotinoids that are used on the crops.
The chemicals is manufactured by Bayer, but the Bayer and Monsanto have entered into a marketing agreement where Bayer is supplying the chemical and Monsanto is putting on their seed crops.
Yeah. Any idea how much profit is made?
I don't know how much profit is made, but I seen a figure the other day that said that there was $750 some million worth of it sold in the United States last year.
Well, see there, that's part of, I think, the problem here. This is kind of interesting, too, because this the information I just quoted was from a study done in 2004, and you mentioned in an earlier discussion that a couple of years ago, these coated seeds were being handed out to farmers to try in their fields. Talk about that.
Well, we've got, you know, talking, like I say, my background is in farming, and you know, last year, and especially last year, farmers were basically given bags of seed with seed treatment on it, you know, and to try it and to see how it liked it. Well, you know, you don't have to spray, and you know, and all you gotta do is sit in the tractor seat and put it in the ground and come back, you know, and several months later and harvest the crop, you know. Well, that's what you're looking for.
Any information about how extensive this this handout was to the
farmers?
Well,
you know, I've talked to farmers all over the crop growing parts of the United States. I mean, in Iowa and North Dakota and Pennsylvania and New York and you know, and some cotton growers in Texas, and you know, it just seems like everywhere you go, it doesn't matter whether it's sunflowers or soybeans. In fact, a neighbor of mine just told me yesterday that he was flat out right given quite a bit of soybean seed this year just to try it because it was getting late in the season and the plant after the he planted soybeans on wheat ground and the seed company had this here and it was getting late and they weren't going to be able to sell it and you just can't take this stuff out and dump it now. It's got insecticide on it, so they just gave it to him and said, "There, it's yours. Go ahead and plant it."
Well, I'm sure the way that this should progress normally would be that there would be research that to try to get to the bottom of this thing because the impact of the demise of our pollinators could be absolutely critical. We're having enough problems with tainted foods coming from China and other places and issues of even transporting foods to this country because of the carbon footprints, et cetera, et cetera. It seems as if the more that we can actually grow back here at home and do that effectively, the better off we're going to be. And then all of a sudden we're hit with this. But it does seem, based on some reasonable discussion here, that there is a correlation between the honeybee problem and the neonicotinoids. I will someday get that right. So what would be required should be research. And there's an amazing story, and that's really what caught my attention, about what happened in Congress just this last week that I think needs to really be looked at. Someone needs to take a deep look at what happened.
Well, basically, you know, we've been told, and the industry's been told, and the two national beekeeping organizations, the American Beekeeping Federation and the American Honey Producers, who were worked jointly together for some congressional issues, and you know, we've been told that you know, for months that, you know, when a new farm bill comes around, there'll be plenty of money here, and we'll come up with, you know, lots of money for research. Fact of the matter is, a couple weeks ago, the researchers in Washington sat down and laid out a protocol where the money was going to go. Got it here at my desk somewhere, but anyhow, it's an action plan. It's 26 pages long. And, of course, to run this action plan, it's going to take money. And I mean, Congress, you know, the House side, who debated the farm bill last week and worked on it for a couple weeks or now, basically, you know, gave us all kind of insurances that, you know, there would be money available and so on and so forth. Long story short, in committees, it got kind of booted aside for one reason or another. From there, it went on to into the House Ag Committee, and nothing happened there either. We ended up with a ag bill on the floor of the House last Wednesday, I guess it was, with no provisions in there whatsoever for research for honeybees.
There's an angle to this that actually there was one congressman. Is this Dennis Cardoza?
Yes, there was $5 to $7 million supposed to come out of the specialty crop committee there. A motion was made.
Right.
Was made there in that committee to
fund the research. Yeah,
for research for honeybees. Yeah. And after some negotiations back and forth, which we don't know exactly what will happen, that the motion was withdrawn. And so out of the subcommittee on specialty crops, which there's a whole list of them of specialty crops, and basically two-thirds of the people involved in specialty crops need honeybees for pollination. Without honeybees, you know, the melons and the blueberries and, you know, the cherries, you know, the apples, it just, the list goes on and on. They just wouldn't be there. I mean, there's no such plant and stuff if you ain't got bees to pollinate it.
Well, I don't understand.
Well, nobody else does.
Is how in the world a congressman can, and I'm not necessarily saying directing this at Dennis Cardoza, but I sure wish he'd give an answer, how he would come up with a proposal to offer $5 to $7 million, which is a small amount of money in this day and age, to do what everybody in America wants to know. They want to know what's causing this, and then to have that small amount of money suddenly withdrawn. It's one thing to maybe say, oh, well, we can't give you $5 to $7, we'll give you $4. But to literally just withdraw the motion for that support, there is something, I just have to wonder why, and hopefully someone will begin to ask that question. What in the world happened, and why is it there is at this
well,
point?
Well, you know, we asked the same question, and you know, and maybe there's an answer out there, and we hope it's a good answer, and you know, you know, we're giving them the benefit of the doubt, but we would, you know, it would be sure nice if somebody would give us the answer.
Monsanto and other chemical companies like that have a lot of power, in government right now. And I'm sure someone might be proposing that perhaps there was some pressure put somewhere, some deals made or whatever else. I don't know if that's the case, and I'm sure you don't either.
That's right.
But I do think that someone needs to ask that question and find out, because this is really a very serious problem.
Well, I don't know if we'd ever get a straight answer. I mean, we'd like to have a straight answer. I mean, that's what we send these people to Washington for, to give us some straight answers. But whether we get a straight answer or not, that's beside the point. Fortunately, when it got on the House floor and Congressman Hastings from Florida injected a lot better plan than what was coming out of the subcommittee, and that did pass. I mean, unanimously. Unfortunately, my comment about that is once it's on the floor of the House, and you know that we're going to provide some money to keep food on Americans' dinner tables. Well, it's kind of hard for Congress to vote against it. Now it's got to, you know, the Senate and the President all have to do their thing yet. But so there is some money there available. But what happened in the beginning is what we're trying to find out.
Yeah.
Why did this all happen?
I appreciate that update too. I actually hadn't heard that. I'm glad to know that at least the House has stepped up to fund this. Now, but as we move on then from this point, let's say that it were. Let's say for those people who think that perhaps there is a relationship between the neonicotinoids and the disappearance of the honeybees, what would be some reasonable solutions? Now, of course, the farmers are put in a difficult position, although they've gotten along without this chemical before. Is there a compromise? Is there some sort of meeting of the steps that can be taken to protect the bees and the farmers and the American public at this point?
Well, there's a lot of things that probably could happen, and I mean, I understand, if I was in the farmer's shoes, I'd be glad, the economics of farming are not what they ought to be either, and you know, the farmer's having a hard time, the beekeeper's having a hard time. We have all kinds of subsidy programs for corn and wheat and cotton, and you know, all the big crops get direct subsidies, you know, and I'm not a subsidy person, but if we're going to subsidize those people, then maybe what needs to be done, we need pollinators, and this has been proposed, had already been proposed by national bee organizations to Congress earlier on in this year, is the fact that maybe what we need is in some kind of an incentive program to beekeepers just to keep them alive, you know, a payment for, because you are a pollinator and you're pollinating crops. We're talking about some serious money here. $18 billion, Congress's numbers this week out of Congress, or last week out of Congress, is $18 billion worth of farm commodities that are directly responsible or directly dependent on the honeybee. We're talking about $18 billion worth of produce that's produced in this country is directly comes from the honeybee. One out of every three bites is directly responsible, the honeybee is directly responsible for. So, you know, if we're going to eat American-produced produce, you know, and vegetables, then maybe the taxpayers need to step up to the plate and, you know, help to keep the bees here, or if we're going to keep these chemicals here. I mean, it's a long shot, and however it works out. I mean, if we're going to continue to use these chemicals, the people use them got to be more responsible. But there's things like the seed treatment on corn, you know, with my pollinating pumpkins, I can't get away from the corn. The pumpkins are planted. I was out today working bees and pumpkins, 150 acres of pumpkins and surrounded by 2,000 acres of corn. And the bees work the corn for the pollen. You know, I'm renting bees to a grower that needs bees to pollinate his pumpkins, but there's the corn and I can't get away from it.
You can't just tell them, buddies, go out there and just do the pumpkins.
Right, that's right. The bees don't understand that.
Yeah, just can't learn that. Let's also talk a little bit about, are we looking at it in the future here this fall and then also over the winter and next spring? Any indications of where this may be going at this point?
Somehow I became an expert in this thing overnight. I was quoted in the New Yorker a couple days ago about I was the expert or something. I'm no expert. I didn't know nothing about this 6 months ago. I get phone calls every week and sometimes daily from beekeepers across the country, you know, wanting to know what to do. And I don't know what to do. I mean, I'm the guy that basically half figured out there was a problem, but, you know, and my answer is run as far away from this stuff as you can, but you can't do that. And we're already seeing in Colorado and Florida and Georgia and New York especially, we're seeing beekeepers that already have bees collapsing. Why? You know, some of them have been around some of these products pollinating apples, pollinating vegetables already this year and are already seeing the effects of it. What's going to happen? I mean, what the bees that are next to cotton, we have beekeepers that are, have large operations with thousands of beehives that have gone to cotton for years, and cotton farmers don't pay to rent bees, but they're happy to have them because it increases the fiber in their cotton, and that's how they sell cotton, by the pound of fiber. So we already have cotton growers calling beekeepers up, asking them, are you coming back? And a lot of beekeepers in Texas and Arkansas and places like that, and the guys that go there are saying, well, we're probably not coming back because we've lost 80-90% of all the bees we had sitting on cotton last year.
Wow.
Disappeared. So, you know, in that case, you know, if those guys can run their bees in the wild brush someplace in Texas and get away from that, from the cultivated crops that's using these products, they're going to probably be in a lot better shape. The guys that, you know, are still out here have to do some pollination, and that's their business, and it's going to be a crapshoot what happens come November, January again this year.
Well, if the neonicotinoids are continue to be used, and I don't see any effort on this, at least at this point, to put some sort of ban or controls on that. If I were king of the universe, I would take one state and ban it from that state just as a test to see how that might affect the bee population. If it is the neonicotinoids, we need to know that.
That's right. And there is some research being done right now by Penn State and others in the USDA, and Penn State's pretty much taking the lead in this whole thing, but they definitely got some neonicotinoid research going on, and it's going to be interesting to see. They're collecting pollen off of plants and, you know, where the bees are around this stuff to see how much is coming back. We have a U.S. government lab, a DA lab, that is capable of looking at pollen samples and telling you exactly what's in there, and we're talking about a pollen sample the size of the end of your little finger. Now, that's not a lot of pollen, but we've already, across the country, they've done several dozen samples that they've taken last winter, and we're already finding not only neonicotinoids there, but other chemicals and insecticides that some of them haven't been used for a number of years. So here comes another problem. Do we have a stack effect here because of all this different insecticides? Do we have something going on because these things have gotten mixed together?
Yeah.
I mean, there's just all kinds of scenarios out here that really, does it have something to do with because they're mixing these chemicals with already genetically modified crops, with the BT toxins in there? I mean, some scientists, German scientists and a Canadian scientist says that this is our problem. This is one of our problems. We're mixing the BTs with the seed treatment with the BTs, and now you got a cocktail.
Well, there's a lot to be said for organic farming, for example. And I'm just curious if you've had any chance to if any people who are working in the organic farm industry are talking about bees and their crops.
Well, I was on a talk show yesterday. It was one of the things that I have noticed is the fact that people who have been around organic or around the wild, I mean, I just had a conversation with a beekeeper out of Georgia yesterday who basically moves bees from the woods to the woods, like I say. He basically runs bees out in the wild. He don't pollinate any crops. He's still trying to survive on producing honey because he's scared to death of what's going to happen if he moves, you know, into pollination. So he basically is going from the woods in Florida and producing gallberry and palmetto and things like that up into Georgia and some wild crops there, and turning around going back south into Florida. And my conversation with him yesterday was the fact that his bees are still doing well. And last winter he had bees sitting right alongside of our bees in Florida that never collapsed. But his history has been not pollinating crops where where these chemicals are being used.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people who really wish that we could become a little more organic, a little more sustainable. Some people would even say a lot more organic and a lot more sustainable. And perhaps the story of the honeybees is one that really does speak to that. It just seems as if sometimes these the chemicals that we're a little ahead of ourselves on some of these things. And unfortunately, whereas there used to be controls and there was an EPA that was there to really test these things out before they were unleashed into the public, it seems as if now they're unleashed into the public and that if something happens, you're supposed to go after the, you're supposed to fix the problem. But a lot of beekeepers have been bashed out of business. They're put out of business. And just straight across, just a, in a good old capitalist world, that's not fair. You know, people like yourselves who work hard, try to make a good living, make a little profit, for them to be affected so dramatically by another larger industry and forced out of business is inequitable and unfair. Maybe we'll someday turn that around a bit. Any last thoughts here in terms of what you think people should do to help you out and others who are concerned about the honeybees?
Pick up your phone, call your congressman and senator and tell them you need food to eat. And, you know, without honeybees, you know, we're going to be eating Chinese food and so on that we have no control over in Mexican food and you know, that we have no control over what's in that food. And as we've all seen in the news in the last couple of months, you know, it's pretty evident what has been being shipped into our country. And with a little restraint, I mean, most of the food that comes in, nobody pays any attention to, and the little bit they are looking at, they're turning around and sending it back.
Well, as I was preparing to do this interview with you, the old phrase, think globally, act locally, came to mind, but I thought that isn't quite appropriate. And what actually came, then it morphed into was think nationally, act rationally. And I think maybe that's the new mantra. Think nationally, act rationally. That's really what we have to think. We have to think about this country and our people and our way of life, and we do have to protect ourselves. And people like you are a foundation, literally, for the survival of this country. We're talking with Dave Hackenberg, who operates Hackenberg Apiaries. Dave, why don't you tell people about how they can find out more about your business?
We have a website called Buffy Bee, get on there, I have to admit I don't look at it very much myself. I'm told it's pretty interesting and talks about what we do, and I'm too busy basically running bees. But
Dave, you've got a beautiful website. I encourage everybody to go there. That's a fancy show place.
A couple of my kids here are my children. I have four children. I have a son in the bee business with me, but I have a son that's in the movie making business and a couple daughters here that are basically looking after that, and they do a fine job with it.
They did an excellent job. You've got one of the finer websites in the world. Dave Hackenberg, thanks so much, and good luck, and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you.
Well, this wraps up another in our summer series here on the Wild Side News. Again, I want to send my condolences out to people in Minnesota, my friends there. Minnesota is my state, and wish them well in the days and months ahead in their efforts to recover from the tangled mess of the 35W bridge over the Mississippi River. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to bring you lots of new shows going in-depth, covering the most important issues that affect you and affect the world and the wonder. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again. When your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.